Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined by my colleague, Alistair Benn. Alistair, we're going to talk a bit about Boris, aren't we, later? Though I'm very conscious that some people are completely bored to tears by the whole Partygate thing. The country seems a bit divided on whether they think it's an appalling scandal that's about to bring him down, or something that people want to forget. But we'll come back to that in a bit. We want to talk about the war first. Where do you think we are? We're now a couple of months in. The Ukrainians have fought back very bravely, but the next phase of the war is beginning.
Yeah, so there's several sort of theories fly around. I mean, the first is not a theory. It's just what the Russians have said they're doing, which is a sort of the second phase of the special operation, the so-called special operation, which is to basically create a land corridor to Crimea and to control the whole of the Donbass region, plus to create a kind of Kherson People's Republic. And people remember Kherson as one of the first cities to be occupied by Russian troops. So that's what the Russians are saying they're doing next. And then there are sort of various theories in the West and the commentariat and about Russia's prospects in being able to complete those aims. I mean, on the one hand, there's the theory that the Times reported today, which is quotes from intelligence officials, unnamed intelligence officials, saying Russia is probably going to have some success over the next couple of months. It's, you know, they've appointed a new supreme commander of the armed forces, Dvornikov, who has a record of extreme brutality in Syria, for example. And, you know, they're saying, okay, the Russians are getting their act together. They're proceeding on one front rather than several. Their kind of tank tactics and the heavy stuff will be easier to maneuver on the kind of flat plains of the Donbass region, the kind of open spaces.
So that is that the theory is there. It's easier than the space around Kiev.
That's the exactly, in which is more woody and bogs and all that, and you have to go along roads which are easy to ambush. So that's a theory. But then there's the other side of that, which is less positive for the Russians, which is people argue that they're actually really depleted. this idea that they're going to be able to launch a kind of blitzkrieg, sort of advance with the kind of resources that they have available to them, is pretty, it's kind of doubtful. And actually they're going to encounter some really well dug in Ukrainian opposition, and it's going to be very difficult and bloody for them to do that. So there are a few sort of, I would say there are sort of various theories flying around. I think in terms of just simply thinking about what Putin wants from the second phase, in 2017 or around then, about 5 years ago, Putin did speculate, I think, in an interview about this idea of Novorossiya, which would be an area of land pretty similar to the goals that they've outlined in the special operation. So he speculated that partitioning Ukraine along those lines, i.e. a land corridor with Crimea through to the rest of Russia and the Donbass, you know, would be a kind of, it would align with a 19th century unit of lands, which was part of Tsarist Russia called Novorossiya, which was kind of similar territory. So in that sense, if you're going to read the runes, you know, maybe aligns with that. But, you know, that's just a speculation. Yeah. No certain answers, really. It's going to be fascinating in a kind of morbid way, because we are, it's sort of like the stakes are going up and up. And for Russia, at any rate, for Ukraine, and will be crucial.
Yeah, it's very difficult to know, isn't it? I find people in the know in the run-up to the invasion, who were very pro-Ukraine, obviously, but doubtful that Ukraine could sustain resistance, and we're thinking in terms of a guerrilla war. And that isn't what happened, and Ukraine managed to, around Kiev, fight off the Russians and deny them the quick victory. The line now seems to be, and if you look at the MOD briefings and the stuff coming out of the US, the line is, well, first phase, success from the point of view of the Ukrainians, but don't write off the Russians because they still, you know, they still have might and not right on their side. So get ready for a really tough next phase. However, so morale has got to play a part in this as well, doesn't it? If you think how bedraggled the Russians are after that first phase, and they're fighting people who are, as you said, Alistair, dug in, and who have proven their critics and their friends and supporters in the West wrong. Which also, I think, I'm fascinated by the geopolitical shifts going on at the moment. And just a quick plug for Engelsberg Ideas, which Alistair works on, which the Reaction team helped produce. Engelsberg Ideas, if you haven't read it, www.engelsbergideas.com, which is run by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and features a lot of the world's best historians, and obviously when it comes to this war, some great strategic thinking and historical insights. Really interesting piece this week on Engelsberg Ideas, Alistair, about Russia and India, which is very much in the news at the moment. And people, maybe you can explain a bit of the background, actually. Why is it, and people still seem slightly perplexed, that India and Russia are de facto allies, which puts the Brits in an odd position. Boris Johnson in India this week for meetings and trying to boost the possibility of a trade deal, but also knowing that India looks to Russia for defence equipment and has a long-running alliance.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we've talked about it in that it's, well, the interesting comparison is geopolitical divides and values divides, even during the Cold War, were muddied by resource, you know, as you know, desire to have resources. So, you know, whole of Europe towards the end of the Cold War, although notionally in a, you know, dance of death with the Soviets machine, was also buying loads of gas from the Soviet Union. So, I mean,
and oil, yeah.
So it's, you know, the, in terms of the Indian, and you look at Turkey, sells drones to the Ukrainians, but then has a strategic sort of, you know, in terms of energy, is close to Russia, and then it's part of NATO. So I think for a country like India, which this essay on EI is really really good sort of deep dive into all these dynamics, is India wants to, you know, wants its strategic autonomy, and thinks that at the moment that strategic autonomy is sort of best sort of buttressed by sort of, you know, being a bit between, you know, going between Russia and China, sidling up to Russia, sort of trying to combat Pakistan to the west and north in terms of developing strategic depth. I mean, it's all quite, you know, I'm not equipped to talk through it. You know, have to talk to someone who knows more about it. But India has,
or read the essay by Jack exactly, Watling and one of his colleagues.
Exactly, and the I mean, the thing that really jumped out to me is we have to understand that there are histories with lots of countries around the globe, which are, you know, do mean that they are more preconditioned to accept Russian claims around the conflict.
Yeah. It's the
or
legacy
to look the other way.
Yeah. It's the legacy being legacy of being non-aligned, or thinking about the world in exactly. world in a different way.
Exactly. So, you know, India has a long sort of, you know, it was a had a lot of partnerships with the Soviet world. It was seen as a kind of non-aligned post-colonial ally in some ways. But India, of course, wasn't quite part of the Soviet world as it was, with all these kinds of exchange programs and, sort of something we forget, the way in which Cubans would go to East Germany or Nicaragua or, or Vietnam or whatever. And this was a real social phenomenon with people, lots of interchange. But India wasn't quite part of that. But yeah, I think it, I for Britain, I don't think there's necessarily a contradiction between wanting to develop trade ties with India and being on the other side of of the geopolitical conflict in Europe. I don't necessarily see how you have to be either one thing or the other. And
And
what are you thinking?
it is complex because India's obviously also got this problem with China, but maybe sees an opportunity for some sort of rapprochement with China, but it then has effectively a proxy war in Pakistan, or sort of security crisis in Pakistan, and then trying to looks to Russia for historic reasons, and also its weaponry comes from Russia. So India's conflicted. I suppose the UK governments, they take the view that you have to keep talking, and there's all sorts of stuff you can do on trade, and then that gradually over time, if you can put the theory is if you can pull India more into the orbit of the West, or what's termed D10, the democracies. And that's the Australian view, and the Australians have taken the lead on this in many respects, in trying to bolster the relationship between India and Australia, and saying to the British, look, India can be an ally, but it's in a complex situation, and it's going to take time and years, decades even, to move it into, well, India would reject the term move it into the Western orbit, but move it and make it become part of, ensure it can become part of some alliance of the democracies against the autocracies. But we'll see. The other dynamic that's going on, of course, we're recording this ahead of the French election. Looks like he's home and dry, though the latest poll has a 6-point gap, so you never know. Strange things with turnout. We'll see, but it looks as though Macron is heading for victory. But then in Germany, you have, and it's been picked up very little in the, there have been some good stories written in the UK press and in the American press, but the scale of the meltdown in German politics, I just find engrossing at the moment, where you have this situation where Scholz, the new chancellor, initially was regarded as heroic, really, because of that famous Sunday morning performance straight after the war, essentially undoing 10, 20 years of German policy, promising to spend 100 billion euros on defence, promising, sort of, to help Ukraine, and announcing a complete rethink of German political attitudes to Russia and to European defence. So he was hailed as a hero for this, and then of course, it's become more complicated than that, and he's now under fire over the failure to send heavy weapons and weapons in sufficient quantity to aid Ukraine, with his coalition partners taking a different view, the Greens, and increasingly the German tabloids and the German media going after Scholz on the basis of, is he telling the truth about this? And there's been a row running all week about how truthful the Chancellor has been. So German politics is being stress tested by this, with German business saying, well, look, you cannot have a situation in which German business can't unhook itself, certainly not quickly, from Russian energy supplies, because the German model post-reunification, which there was no guarantee that Germany was going to be a success after unification, had a very difficult period economically, and then discovers essentially that if it can, the new model it designs is it can suck in cheap energy from Russia and then export to places like China. And on that basis, the German economy has been very, very successful. So that model is now in doubt. So I would just say look out for Germany at the moment, but we'll also talk about the French election, and maybe there's a shock coming, but it doesn't feel like it, don't you think? You're off to Paris actually on the weekend, and we'll write from there at some point.
Yes, I'm excited to cover it and to well, I mean, from a journalistic perspective, it's going to be more interesting if Le Pen wins. But you know, I think Macron is going to win. I think the interesting, you know, I think it's been a low key campaign. It's not felt like a particularly, even though the stakes are actually really high in terms of the future of France and Europe in so many ways, and the future of the French, you know, model. It hasn't felt like the stakes are high, I think, in France, and people have been quite not really motivated. Macron's campaign hasn't been very energized. And yeah, it's been very low key. The interesting thing, I mean, the most interesting thing actually about the campaign is actually Marine Le Pen's retail politics and her offer to young people, which I wonder is something. Sort of the right outside France, you know, might learn from, I guess, is that the, you know, whereas Macron, for various cultural reasons, appeals to older voters, Le Pen does better among younger voters, and she has these policies which are just wouldn't happen, I think, in this country, in terms of massive transfers in wealth to young people. Loads of, you know, just a big offers in terms of on tax and on various kind of loopholes. It's all geared towards young people. And I think obviously that I think contradicts the feeling in this country where, you know, the spirit of revolt at the, you know, the inequitable housing settlements and the way young people seem to be at the sharp end of a lot of the kind of economic problems in the UK is that, you know, the Conservative Party dominates among older voters, and then younger people tend to, you know, have voted for Corbyn in relatively large numbers and all the rest. So that struck me as quite interesting and a departure for Le Pen from previous offers,
It's
which have been
interesting.
more
Yeah, I
about the
noticed.
immigration and
Yeah.
citizenship angle.
I noticed that her, in the latest polling, which does have Macron in the pretty strongly in the lead, he seems to have turned it around among, I mean, it's one poll and it's one subset of a sample, but that he seemed to be in the lead among very young voters, sort of 18 to 24, fairly narrowly. But it's when you get into that late 20s, 30s, even into the early 40s, so into young professionals, people making their way in life, really feeling the squeeze, then she does have a large lead. Yeah, I did think something similar actually, when I wondered whether the Tories, who have in the UK, who have switched, who are hailing increased immigration from non-EU sources, and that of course is really pretty much what Boris Johnson always sought, or would claim that he always sought post-Brexit. And you see the beginnings potentially, I'm not sure if, I don't know to what extent, this is just supposition, I'm not so sure to what extent is designed in this way, but that they'll pivot to being the party of high-skilled, serve the NHS, boost tech, boost the economy, immigration from non-European sources. And that's a position. I'm not sure that Boris can sell it, but that's a position longer term, a cosmopolitan position, which is potentially going to alienate quite a lot of older Conservative voters, part of that Boris Brexit coalition, which is disintegrating anyway. And is there something there in which a way in which for them to appeal to younger Britons? But the stuff that you're talking about, tax breaks for being young, the stuff that she's the stuff that she's doing, which I'm not convinced she'd actually be able to implement. There's no sign of that in UK politics. It'd be interesting to see whether Labour pitch themselves more towards the young as the next election comes up, which brings us on to, and we've just got a couple of minutes left to talk about Boris Johnson and Partygate and all that stuff, which is, as I say, boring some people and enthralling others. Do you think he survives all of this, Alistair?
I think if he keeps on being fined, which seems kind of likely slash inevitable, actually, and it keeps on coming out, then his authority will continue to be damaged. But, he's also incredibly stubborn and doesn't believe the rules apply to him in quite the same way as I think that other leaders might have. He will dig in and do and use every trick in the book and fudge it and keep on going. But I just, well, you might have a different view. It just seems very unlikely that he won't be fined again. And then the fines will rack up, and there's potential top ceiling of a £10,000 fine or something if you keep on being fined for being at parties and organizing them. I mean, is that likely or not? And I just think if the answer is that's likely to happen, I can't understand how he does survive in a kind of rational world, because all the defenses he made in the first one, which is it's just a birthday cake, he was just getting on with his job, looks stupid.
But you've also seen this week the real importance of what happened this week, and the Tory party still seems to be some way away from actually resolving that it's going to remove him and that the war changed the dynamic. But it was a really interesting week because, similar to the Paterson case, where they got themselves into such a mess by just misunderstanding what the opinion was in Parliament. You've got to, I mean, Boris has never understood Parliament. He's not really a creature of the Commons or the Commons chamber. It's a means to an end. He's not a House of Commons man. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But if you want to govern, to run an administration, you've got to really understand the sort of ebb and flow of Commons opinion, how the place works. And you rely on that, but you rely then on the whipping operation to tell you, but he doesn't really seem to listen. So how can you have a situation where the Prime Minister has a majority, the Tories have a majority of 75, was 80, 75, I think, and he doesn't really have a majority of 75. It is contingent, and he's very vulnerable to cock-ups and screw-ups and 30 to 40 Tory MPs deciding that they're not going to put up with it, and that forces the government to collapse, which it did this week, and essentially tried to kick the parliamentary investigation into whether or not he misled Parliament, tried to kick that into the long grass, and then discovered too late, once it had proposed this, that the parliamentary party, large numbers of Tories, or enough, and you don't need it, doesn't need to be 100 or 200, just as I said, needs to be 40 or 50. And there are more than enough rebels to say, no, we're not voting for this. And they risk a humiliating defeat and they have to climb down. A quite remarkable position for a government with a notionally healthy majority to be in. So I keep saying to people, remember, it doesn't really have the majority that you think he has. I think the other factor, and the great thing in his favour is that he just won't resign. Because he won't resign, because he won't resign, because he never resigns. And he will, if he is removed, he'll have to be dragged kicking and screaming out of there, and he'll threaten to bring the whole house down. I mean, he won't have any care afterwards if he is removed for his party, and I suspect his party knows that. I think the real, really important story of the week in the UK that this is all happening against the backdrop of what's really going to dictate his future and the result of the next election is the economic stuff. If you see the fall in retail sales, you see what's happening with inflation, the way in which businesses are reporting that people are really starting to feel the squeeze and consumer behavior is changing potentially a lot, and the full impact of increased bills has yet to land. So they're going into a 6-month phase where it's going to be brutal on the consumer front, and there's going to be a lot of pain felt by the time you get to the autumn. So I think that's ultimately what will decide it. If the economic situation was more benign, maybe there's a series of excuses he could resolve about moving on from the pandemic. But if he's getting fined and getting hammered by his own party, and the economic situation gets as bad as some people fear that it will moving into the second half of the year, that's if something does him in, I suspect it will be the economy. But I think we're going to wrap it up there for this week, Alistair, because we've got to go off, and I've got to go off and sort out some more of our defence conference, the Defence of Europe conference, which is happening on the 9th of May at Bush House, a reaction conference in partnership, co-hosted by King's College London, the War Studies team and the Defence Studies team. And the tickets are going live this weekend. So if you're a reaction subscriber, there's a batch of tickets set aside, first come, first served for reaction subscribers. And join us. We have a stellar group of keynote speakers and panelists, and we'll be discussing how Ukraine can be helped, how European security can be best boosted, and what's the future of warfare. As I say, with a stellar cast on the day. That's the 9th of May, all day at Bush House, Reaction and King's College London. But until next time, you've been listening to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, and Alistair Benn. Thank you for listening.